Let's spend another hour in the Life Divine. We're in the 24th chapter, The Evolution of the Spiritual Man. And in the last section that opened the chapter, Sri Aurobindo was pointing out that our view of the world is limited to superficies, to the surface of things, until we are capable of developing a deeper view, arriving at another prospect through the evolution of consciousness. We can achieve that and in so doing release the indwelling spirit from its encasement in matter, and then we have the fulfillment of the evolutionary movement. What emerges at the end is what involves from the beginning, from the original movement. And following an old dictum in Sanskrit philosophy, Satkaryavada, that in the original truth is the thing that will emerge, that the effect comes out of the cause, that it already pre-exists. So the final stage of evolution, which is the full emergence of the spirit, is there at the very beginning, in the first thesis, the first postulate of the universe. So as the divine creative consciousness conceives of this possibility of descending into its apparent opposite, already the victory is assured, because the truth does not abandon itself. Truth is asleep. It is the very foundation of the universe. In matter is Sat. From Sat, Chit and Ananda must emerge. The fullness of the spirit must emerge. It is a cosmic necessity. So we've come to another portion of Sri Aurobindo's argument, starting from that. It is true again that it is difficult for man's mind to distinguish entirely the soul or self or any spiritual element in him from the mental and vital formation in which it makes its appearance. But that is only so long as the emergence is not complete. In the animal, mind is not quite distinct from its own life matrix and life matter. Its movements are so involved in the life movements that it cannot detach itself from them, cannot stand separate and observe them. But in man, mind has become separate. He can become aware of his mental operations as distinct from his life operations. His thought and will can disengage themselves from his sensations and impulses, desires and emotional reactions, can become detached from them, observe and control them, sanction or cancel their functioning. He does not as yet know the secrets of his being well enough to be aware of himself decisively and with certitude as a mental being in a life and body, but he has that impression and can take inwardly that position. So we may think that we know and are master of ourselves. We don't really have that knowledge or mastery, but we're moving towards it. So there is this separative power in the mind's cognition, which can disengage and view the operations of nature. That is a first point and a movement towards liberation. He continues, so too, at first, soul in man does not appear as something quite distinct from mind and from mentalized life. Its movements are involved in the mind movements. Its operations seem to be mental and emotional activities. The mental human being is not aware of a soul in him, standing back from the mind and life and body, detaching itself, seeing and controlling and molding their action and formation. But as the inner evolution proceeds, this is precisely what can, must, and does happen. It is the long-delayed but inevitable next step in our evolutionary destiny. There can be a decisive emergence in which the being separates itself from thought and sees itself in an inner silence as the spirit in mind, or separates itself from the life movements, desires, sensations, kinetic impulses, and is aware of itself as the spirit supporting life, or separates itself from the body sense and knows itself as a spirit ensouling matter. This is the discovery of ourselves as the Purusha, a mental being or a life soul or a subtle self supporting the body. So because the presence of the soul is so enmeshed in the beginnings of evolving consciousness, we can't readily distinguish them. Eventually, the mind begins to separate itself from the operations of nature. And if it casts a view upon the soul, it thinks it is something other than what it is. It sees it as distinct from some parts of our nature, not distinct from others. But this decisive emergence allows us to step back and view mind, life, and body separately. So then Purusha stations itself at the level of the mind, becomes the Manomaya Purusha at the level of life, becomes Pranamaya Purusha at the level of the body, becomes Annamaya Purusha. But the suggestion is that behind these positions of the Purusha supporting and, in a sense, indwelling the nature vehicles, there is a greater self behind. So Sri Aurobindo has to call our attention to the fact that we must go beyond that, this initial distinction between person and aspect of nature. This is taken by many, he writes, as a sufficient discovery of the true self. And in a certain sense, they are right, for it is the self or spirit that so represents itself in regard to the activities of nature, and this revelation of its presence is enough to disengage the spiritual element. But self-discovery can go farther. It can even put aside all relation to form or action of nature. For it is seen that these selves are representations of a divine entity to which mind, life, and body are only forms and instruments. We are then the soul looking at nature, knowing all her dynamisms in us, not by mental perception and observation, but by an intrinsic consciousness and its direct sense of things and its intimate, exact vision, able therefore by its emergence to put a close control on our nature and change it. So while we may be able to become aware of the sense of the Purusha stationed at the level of the mind or of the life or of the body, if we push back, we can find what is a true distinction of Purusha from Prakriti, of conscious witness from nature in front, the vehicle in which the nature rides. But it is important here to note what he suggests. Able, therefore, by its emergence, the emergence of this Purusha consciousness, to put a close control on our nature and change it. In other words, Purusha has the power to effect a transformation of nature. This is not part of the Sankhya philosophy, as originally formulated, you know, in classical times. It may not be the original Sankhya, which was primarily this distinction between Purusha and Prakriti. We won't get into a historical discussion about that. But to Sri Aurobindo, the consciousness of the Purusha has innate within it the capacity to command Prakriti, an extension of itself ultimately, to obey. First, we must arrive at this station of Purusha behind nature. So he continues, when there is a complete silence in the being, either a stillness of the whole being or a stillness behind, unaffected by surface movements, then we can become aware of a self, a spiritual substance of our being, an existence exceeding even the soul individuality, spreading itself into universality, surpassing all dependence on any natural form or action, extending itself upward into a transcendence of which the limits are not visible. It is these liberations of the spiritual part in us which are the decisive steps of the spiritual evolution in nature. So, if we can dwell in this silence of the Purusha, we can proceed beyond that into the wideness of the self, of the Atman consciousness, which is the substance, subjectively, of true being, Sat. And therefore, become commensurate with the universe, step beyond individuality into universality. And then it is a position of consciousness in which we dwell without dependence on form, without dependence on determination, without dependence on a natural location. It need not affix itself to this particular abode, this adhara, which we call our body, our life, our mind. It becomes something broader, much more vast. It is, again, seated in the reality of Sat. And he says again, it is these liberations of the spiritual part in us which are the decisive steps of the spiritual evolution in nature. So, we arrive at mind, we begin to have the capacity to distinguish mind from the other parts of nature. We discover the Purusha behind mind. We discover the self beyond and behind the Purusha. It is a progressive liberation. It is only through these decisive movements that the true character of the evolution becomes evident. For till then, there are only preparatory movements, a pressure of the psychic entity on the mind, life, and body to develop a true soul action. A pressure of the spirit or self for liberation from the ego, from the surface ignorance, a turning of the mind and life towards some occult reality. Occult here means hidden. Preliminary experiences, partial formulations of a spiritualized mind, a spiritualized life, but no complete change, no probability of an entire unveiling of the soul or self, or a radical transformation of the nature. So these preparatory movements are important, but again, they don't lead us to the completeness which is secretly installed at the base of nature. When there is the decisive emergence, one sign of it is the status or action in us of an inherent, intrinsic, self-existent consciousness which knows itself by the mere fact of being, knows all that is in itself in the same way, by identity with it, begins even to see all that to our mind seems external in the same manner. By a movement of identity, or by an intrinsic direct consciousness which envelops, penetrates, enters into its object, discovers itself in the object, is aware in it of something that is not mind or life or body. So he has covered in earlier chapters this matter in a philosophic sense, but here he's transcribing what is experiential. He's describing here this self-existent consciousness. Self, the existence of the self, sat, aware of itself, chit, which does through its own power, shakti, tapas, what it wills. So if we become aware of that, we get to the secret reality behind indwelling in mind, life, and body. There is then, evidently, a spiritual consciousness which is other than the mental, and it testifies to the existence of a spiritual being in us which is other than our surface mental personality. But at first, this consciousness may confine itself to a status of being separate from the action of our ignorant surface nature, observing it, limiting itself to knowledge, to a seeing of things with a spiritual sense and vision of existence. For action, it may still depend upon the mental, vital, bodily instruments, or it may allow them to act according to their own nature and itself remain satisfied with self-experience and self-knowledge, with an inner liberation and eventual freedom. But it may also, and usually does, exercise a certain authority, governance, influence on thought, life movement, physical action, a purifying, uplifting control, compelling them to move in a higher and purer truth of themselves, to obey or be an instrumentation of an influx of some diviner power, or a luminous direction which is not mental but spiritual and can be recognized as having a certain divine character, the inspiration of a greater self, or the command of the ruler of all being, the Ishvara. So the spirit can first stand back separate, and then it can dwell satisfied in its separation from nature, and not engage itself in the play of the world and effecting a change in the nature that it possesses. It is, to use the old phrase, atmarati, involved in the delight of its own being. But too, Sri Aurobindo notes that the power of this spirit being realized in a person means that usually It will, this spiritual consciousness, impose its influence to some extent on all the natural machinery, forcing into the mind a purification, a greater vision, into the heart, a nobler feeling, into the body, an action that conducts itself in light of the Spirit. And that it can open to the influence, the flowing down from above, of a divine consciousness in an afflatus from the being of the Lord of the universe, from Ishvara, into our action, and draw through us into the universe a truth which Ishvara wishes to impose. He continues, or the nature may obey the psychic entity's intimations, move in an inner light, follow an inner guidance. This is already a considerable evolution and amounts to a beginning at least of a psychic and spiritual transformation. But it is possible to go farther. For the spiritual being, once inwardly liberated, can develop in mind the higher states of being that are its own natural atmosphere and bring down a supramental energy and action which are proper to the truth consciousness. The ordinary mental instrumentation, life instrumentation, physical instrumentation even, could then be entirely transformed and become parts no longer of an ignorance, however much illumined, but of a supramental creation, which would be the true action of a spiritual truth consciousness and knowledge. So, psychic transformation, spiritual transformation, supramental transformation, one leading to the other. And this idea of a triple transformation is the subject of the next chapter, which we are many pages from, but you can see that Sri Aurobindo is directing our footsteps in that direction now. At first, this truth of the Spirit and of spirituality is not self-evident to the mind. Man becomes mentally aware of his soul as something other than his body. Superior to his normal mind and life, but he has no clear sense of it, only a feeling of some of its effects on his nature. As these effects take a mental form or a life form, the difference is not firmly and trenchantly drawn. The soul perception does not acquire a distinct and assured independence. Very commonly, indeed, a complex of half effects of the psychic pressure on the mental and vital parts, a formation mixed with mental aspiration and vital desires, is mistaken for the soul, just as the separative ego is taken for the self. Although the self, in its true being, is universal as well as individual in its essence. Or, just as a mixture of mental aspiration and vital enthusiasm and ardor uplifted by some kind of strong or high belief or self-dedication or altruistic eagerness is mistaken for spirituality. But this vagueness and these confusions are inevitable as a temporary stage of the evolution which, because ignorance is its starting point and the whole stamp of our first nature, must necessarily begin with an imperfect intuitive perception and an instinctive urge or seeking without any acquired experience or clear knowledge. even the formations, which are the first effects of the perception or urge or the first indices of a spiritual evolution, must inevitably be of this incomplete and tentative nature. But the error so created comes very much in the way of a true understanding. And it must therefore be emphasized that spirituality is not a high intellectuality, not idealism, not an ethical turn of mind or moral purity and austerity, not religiosity or an ardent and exalted emotional fervor, not even a compound of all these excellent things. A mental belief, creed, or faith, an emotional aspiration, a regulation of conduct according to a religious or ethical formula, are not spiritual achievement and experience. These things are of considerable value to mind and life. They are of value to the spiritual evolution itself as preparatory movements disciplining, purifying, or giving a suitable form to the nature. But they still belong to the mental evolution, the beginning of a spiritual realization, experience, change, is not yet there. Spirituality is, in its essence, an awakening to the inner reality of our being, to a spirit, self, soul, which is other than our mind, life, and body, an inner aspiration to know, to feel, to be that, to enter into contact with a greater reality beyond and pervading the universe, which inhabits also our own being. To be in communion with it and union with it, and a turning, a conversion, a transformation of our whole being as a result of the aspiration, the contact, the union, a growth or waking into a new becoming or new being, a new self, a new nature. So you can see in this that Sri Aurobindo has brought a vaster definition of spirituality than any previous view offers. Because here it means that you can't live in the antechambers. You have to get inside to the actual sacred room itself and take your seat there in that reality. You have then to bring the power of that realization into every facet of your being, and it must become something that causes a new energy, a new basis, a new vision to result in a new nature. This is a thoroughgoing transformation. This, to Sri Aurobindo, is spirituality. Not simply a view from outside, but a view that is solid in its realization, but insists on the change of all of the instruments which would work with it. In fact, he writes, the creative consciousness force in our earth existence has to lead forward in an almost simultaneous process, but with a considerable priority and greater stress of the inferior element, a double evolution. Consciousness force, chit shakti. There is an evolution of our outward nature, the nature of the mental being in the life and body, because there is within it pressing forward for self-revelation, because with the emergence of mind, that revelation is becoming possible, a preparation at least, even the beginning of an evolution of our inner being, our occult, subliminal, and spiritual nature. But nature's major preoccupation must necessarily be still, and for a long time, the evolution of mind to its greatest possible range, height, subtlety. For only so can be prepared the unveiling of an entirely intuitive intelligence, of overmind, of supermind, the difficult passage to a higher instrumentation of the spirit. So this is a major challenge for us. The mind must be fully evolved before we can go through these ranges of the higher consciousness, achieve an intuitive humanity, an overmental humanity, a supramental being, which may or may not be humanity, in terms of progressive instrumentations of the spirit. If the mind must be fully evolved, then that means that we on earth must be representative of the human species, must be essentially governed by mind, not by the vital, not by bodily needs. And we can look at our behavior and the way that we conduct ourselves in the world and see that we are anything but that. We are not rational, mental beings yet. Partially mentalized, not fully mentalized. If the sole intention were the revelation of the essential spiritual reality and a cessation of our being into its pure existence, this insistence on the mental evolution would have no purpose. For at every point of the nature, there can be a breaking out of the spirit and an absorption of our being into it. An intensity of the heart, a total silence of the mind, a single absorbing passion of the will would be enough to bring about that culminating movement. So, this is interesting all of its own. If it were enough for us just to get to the spiritual reality, just to achieve a position in that consciousness, then we can do that. There's no need for a stressful mental evolution through the various corridors of mind development towards spiritual manifestation. We can just exit at any point of natural formation. And he's pointed all these out. Love, knowledge, action, the Tri Marga of the Gita, any one of those paths can take you out of nature. Through action, through the experience of love, through the liberation of knowledge. He continues, if nature's final intention were otherworldly, then too the same law would hold. For everywhere, at any point of the nature, there can be a sufficient power of the otherworldly urge to break through and away from the terrestrial action and enter into a spiritual elsewhere. But if her intention is a comprehensive change of the being, this double evolution is intelligible and justifies itself, for it is for that purpose indispensable. The evolution of the outward nature, the evolution of the inward nature. This, however, this double evolution, he means, this, however, imposes a difficult and slow spiritual advance, so we can't do it quickly. For first, the spiritual emergent, has to wait at each step for the instruments to be ready. Next, as the spiritual formation emerges, it is mixed inextricably with the powers, motives, impulses of an imperfect mind, life, and body. There is a pull on it to accept and serve these powers, motives, and impulses. a downward gravitation and perilous mixture, a constant temptation to fall or deviation, at least a fettering, a weight, a retardation. There is a necessity to return upon a step gained in order to bring up something of the nature which hangs back and prevents a farther step. Finally, there is, by the very character of mind in which it has to work, a limitation of the emerging spiritual light and power, and a compulsion on it to move by segments, to follow one line or another, and leave altogether or leave till later on the achievement of its own totality. This hampering, this obstacle of the mind, life, and body, the heavy inertia and persistence of the body, the turbid passions of the life part, the obscurity and doubting and certitudes, denials, other formulations of the mind, is an impediment so great and intolerable that the spiritual urge becomes impatient and tries rigorously to quell these opponents, to reject the life, to mortify the body, to silence the mind and achieve its own separate salvation, spirit departing into pure spirit and rejecting from it altogether an undivine and obscure nature. Note, this is the actual recorded experience of Sri Aurobindo in his notebooks as he dealt with each element of his nature, whether it was mental, vital, or physical, and how some would concede, some would oppose and repel, and how he could conduce them towards the yogic purpose, and how, of course, most spiritual aspirants, growing frustrated with the incapacity of the nature to respond to the spiritual presence, simply say, enough with you. I'm going to where it is silent and cool and serene, and leave the adamant nature behind. You can understand. He continues now. Apart from the supreme call, the natural push of the spiritual part in us to return to its own highest element and status, this aspect of vital and physical nature as an impediment to pure spirituality is a compelling reason for asceticism, for illusionism, for the tendency to otherworldliness, the urge towards withdrawal from life, the passion for a pure and unmixed absolute. So the shramanic urges that we see recorded in the history of Jainism, of Buddhism, in the Shankarite school of Vedanta, we understand. We understand the urge to monasticism so that you can dwell purely in the spirit. A pure spiritual absolutism is a movement of the self towards its own supreme selfhood. But it is also indispensable for nature's own purpose, for without it, the mixture, the downward gravitation, would make the spiritual emergence impossible. So we may, from our vantage, seeing a larger comprehensive picture, think that we ought not to bother with this kind of absolutism which denies the world, but we would be hasty. Because the achievements that these shramanic traditions have got to have made an important mark for humanity's development. If we had not got that, we could not get beyond it. So we must first have the spiritual liberation before we can have the spiritual fulfillment. The extremist of this absolutism, the solitary, the ascetic, is the standard bearer of the spirit. His ochre robe is its flag, the sign of a refusal of all compromise, as indeed the struggle of emergence cannot end by a compromise, but only by an entire spiritual victory and the complete surrender of the lower nature. Yes, we acknowledge it, we must go beyond it. If that is impossible here, then indeed it must be achieved elsewhere. If nature refuses submission to the emerging spirit, then the soul must withdraw from her. There is thus a dual tendency in the spiritual emergence. On one side, a drive towards the establishment at all cost of the spiritual consciousness in the being, even to the rejection of nature. On the other side, a push towards the extension of spirituality to our parts of nature. But until the first is fully achieved, the second can only be imperfect and halting. It is the foundation of the pure spiritual consciousness that is the first object in the evolution of the spiritual man, and it is this and the urge of that consciousness towards contact with the reality, the self, or the divine being, that must be the first and foremost, or even, till it is perfectly accomplished, the sole preoccupation of the spiritual seeker. It is the one thing needful that has to be done by each on whatever line is possible to him, by each according to the spiritual capacity developed in his nature. So, to get to the spiritual status is imperative. Later, we'll make up, combine all, and harmonize every element. But first, we must have that spiritual breakthrough and live in our secret reality. This is where we're going to put our bookmark tonight. We'll resume next week on the 26th of November, after Siddhi Day, the day that marked Sri Aurobindo's great fulfillment, 24th of November, and the founding of the collective yoga in the Sri Aurobindo ashram, which is itself a mission on behalf of humanity. Let's turn tonight to a rather late section in Savitri for a reading. This is in Book 10, The Book of the Double Twilight, Canto 4, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Real. Yet in the exact inconscience stark conceit, in the casual error of the world's ignorance, a plan, a hidden intelligence is glimpsed. There is a purpose in each stumble and fall. Nature's most careless lolling is a pose, preparing some forward step, some deep result. Ingenious notes plugged into a motived score, these million discords dot the harmonious theme of the evolution's huge orchestral dance. A truth supreme has forced the world to be. It has wrapped itself in matter as in a shroud of death, a shroud of ignorance. It compelled the suns to burn through silent space. Flame signs of its uncomprehended thought in a wide brooding ether's formless muse. It made of knowledge a veiled and struggling light, of being a substance nescient, dense and dumb, of bliss the beauty of an insentient world. In finite things the conscious infinite dwells. Involved it sleeps in matter's helpless trance. It rules the world from its sleeping senseless void. Dreaming, it throws out mind and heart and soul to labor, crippled, bound on the hard earth. A broken whole, it works through scattered points. Its gleaming shards are wisdom's diamond thoughts, its shadowy reflex, our ignorance. It starts from the mute mass in countless jets. It fashions a being out of brain and nerve, a sentient creature from its pleasures and pangs. A pack of feelings obscure, a dot of sense survives a while, answering the shocks of life. Then, crushed or its force spent, leaves the dead form, leaves the huge universe in which it lived, an insignificant, unconsidered guest. But the soul grows concealed within its house. It gives to the body its strength and magnificence. It follows aims in an ignorant, aimless world. It lends significance to Earth's meaningless life. A demigod animal, came thinking man. He wallows in mud, yet heavenward soars in thought. He plays and ponders, laughs and weeps and dreams, satisfies his little longings like the beast. He pores upon life's book with student eyes. Out of this tangle of intellect and sense, out of the narrow scope of finite thought, at last he wakes into spiritual mind. A high liberty begins and luminous room. He glimpses eternity, touches the infinite. He meets the gods in great and sudden hours. He feels the universe as his larger self, makes space and time his opportunity to join the heights and depths of being in light. In the heart's cave, speaks secretly with God. But these are touches and high moments lived. Fragments of truth supreme have lit his soul, reflections of the sun in waters still. A few have dared the last supreme ascent, and break through borders of blinding light above, and feel a breath around of mightier air, receive a vaster being's messages, and bathe in its immense intuitive ray. On summit mind, our radiant altitudes exposed to the luster of infinity, outskirts and dependencies of the house of truth, upraised estates of mind and measureless. There man can visit, but there he cannot live. Not and remain man. To that ascension, may we all join hands and walk on a common path. Namaste, Jai Ma.